Hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
Longtime listeners might have noticed something slightly different in this episode. We have a new theme song.
Yay!
Which was generously supplied to us by Paul Terry, who we spoke to a few weeks ago. He is the author of the new X-Files Archives book, which you guys definitely need to check out. But thank you so much, Paul, for your amazing music, and we are thrilled to be sharing it with you guys. And today we are going to continue our mythology series with, wow, what? I mean, the mythology is so good, man. It just gets better and better. This is, we're going to talk tonight about Anasazi.
Mm-hmm.
And Jen, our original plan was to talk about Anasazi, Blessing Way, and Paperclip all in one episode. But
yeah, well, What were we thinking?
I don't know. Jen, I think Jen quickly realized that was not going to happen and texted
it had been
me.
It's a while since I'd watched Anasazi, and when I watched it this week, I was like, there is a lot happening here.
It's a lot. It's a lot, a lot, a lot. So rather than attempt to cram three very, very mythology heavy episodes into one uber long episode, we are going to do Anasazi today for you, and our next mythology episode, which is going to play as our next episode, will be the continuation, which is Blessing Way and Paperclip. But before we get to that, Jen, why don't you read the tweets of the week?
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweets of the week. These tweets are in response to our fabulous interview with Pat Skipper, also known as Bill Scully Jr. Thank you again, Pat, for sharing your time with us and sharing so many really, really interesting insights. And I think our listeners enjoyed it, too. We had quite a bit of response to that. So thank you very much for your tweets, everybody. From SKS, SKS says, when I saw your post, I had to drop what I was doing right away so I could listen. And it was totally worth it. I especially liked Pat Skipper's view on power dynamics and conversations. I'd never thought about it in those terms before, but he's completely right. What an interesting interview and a fantastic idea to invite Pat Skipper. Thank you for an entertaining start to the new year. Well, thank you, SKS. I'm glad that you enjoyed it. Yeah, Pat did have just so many really, really interesting insights into lots of different aspects of his profession and the show. And I'm really glad that he came to chat with us.
Yeah, me too.
From PGS Posts, a.k.a. Pamela. Pamela says, this was great. It gave me not only a different perspective on Bill Jr., but also on Mulder as the quote-unquote first boyfriend ever. The power dynamics discussion was interesting, and I'm always glad to hear people say nice things about the talents of the stars. Good job with the questions. Good job on us, on those questions, Andy. That was great. And Pat was really easy to talk to, which always helps.
He was.
From MGMXF. Just finished listening to your talk with Pat Skipper. Saw him recently in a Criminal Minds episode. Didn't realize he is the definition of a working actor. Wonderful and insightful interview with him. Thank you. Liked his perspective on the power play and bad boyfriend with Mulder. Also, I want to give you two kudos for the fun and interesting X-Files podcast that you do. I've been a longtime fan of X-Files, although my interest ebbs and flows with the realities of real life. But so glad to know that y'all and the fandom are still around, especially this past year. Thanks, MGMXF. That was very kind to say.
Yeah, I love finding like new people who have rediscovered the fandom. I think that's always just so much fun because I remember when I rediscovered the fandom and I was like, or not really rediscovered the fandom, but was like, oh my God, there's all these people just at my fingertips who want to talk about the show. This is amazing. Because I was away from it for such a long time before the revival.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I think maybe most of us have kind of come and gone over the years. I mean, for me, it's been like, you know, 20 odd years. So I don't think I could have kept up that level of commitment for the whole time. But it was really exciting to kind of rediscover the fandom. And it is still here. I mean, it's stronger than ever in some ways. I think the sort of the revival coming along when social media was really, you know, just going the way it was going.
Yeah.
Which was something we didn't have, of course, back when the original show was on, and there was no particular reason for everyone to jump on social media and talk about the X-Files at one time after that until the revival. And so I think that did a lot to kind of get the fandom going again, which is a wonderful thing. We're really happy to be here and glad to have you join us, MGMXF. Thank you.
Yeah.
Monica Filefan says that this was great. Pat is such a sweet guy, always interacting with fans of the show. I love his depiction of the power struggle and acting scenes on the show and how Mulder ends up using his intelligence and empathy to get the upper hand, but only when he feels he's deserving. Monica Filefan. Pat was so great with his, like, he had such a great understanding of the characters, didn't he? Of not just his own character, but the other characters when he was acting with them and what their sort of perspective and motivations were. And I thought that was so interesting.
Yeah, I don't want to say I wasn't expecting that, but I mean, I feel like he had an interesting insight coming in when he did and playing the role that he played. And I thought that was really, really interesting to hear.
Yeah, he was so cool. Isadub says, thanks for this great interview. Pat Skipper has a great and realistic insights about his character, and it was so interesting to learn about his acting process and the behind the scenes. I have never hated Bill Pat. He's not someone I'd be friends with, though. Fair enough, Isadub. I can't imagine wanting to be friends with Bill Scully, but it's nice to know that, you know, he's got some, I don't know if I'm going to say fans, but people that don't hate him at least.
Yeah.
I cannot put myself in the category of people that don't hate Bill Jr. because I kind of do. but I love Pat Skipper, so that's all good.
That helps.
From Jesse, Truth Aftermath. Jesse says, Pat Skipper thankfully gave me a new appreciation for the character of Bill Scully. Once again, Annie and Jen, you deliver a gift to the fandom. Wasn't that sweet to say?
Yeah. Oh,
Jesse. Yeah. Like a Kid in a Candy Store says, thanks ever so much, Jen and Andy, for having these awesome conversation with Pat. So cool. What an interesting point of view as Bill Scully Jr. I grinned, though, when he said that in real life as Pat, he would like Mulder because he usually likes unusual people. Yay. Yeah, that was kind of cool, wasn't it? Pat sounds like he'd be, while I would certainly never be friends with Bill Jr., I feel like Pat and I could be friends because he's a very cool guy, and I'm kind of an unusual person in some way, so I feel like he and I would click. So, you know, call me sometime, Pat. We'll go for drinks sometime when you're up in Edmonton, Alberta. Cassie says, such a great episode. Goes to show how much intelligence, general and emotional, it takes to be an actor. When the general public seems to think that a lot of actors are airheads. Getting some insight into what was going on behind the scenes was also interesting. Yeah, that's a great point. Thanks, Cassie. I think that, Pat definitely really brings this kind of intelligence to his work that not everyone would expect an actor to do. And he's, as we talked in the podcast, he's written a whole book on the acting process, and I can see why, because he is a very thoughtful, articulate guy.
Yeah, he was very, I was going to use the word thoughtful, but like very thoughtful with his words and just had really insightful things to say.
Very much. From Pharmaceutical. Pharmaceutical says, what a great interview. When he brought up the backstage drama, I was like, eyes emoji. I stopped what I was doing and literally my eyes were getting bigger and bigger waiting for him to talk. So many revelations and the Leno thing. This changes everything, really. Pat was super cool. And if you don't know what the Leno thing is, I'm not going to explain it to you. Go and listen to the podcast.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of very, very interesting insights.
It was a lot, a lot, a lot.
Things going on. There was a lot, a lot, a lot. So, yeah, if you haven't listened to it, you really should. It was just a very fun conversation. From Emily Page Ballou, Emily says, I'm much less hard on Chris Carter than many people for the incidences of the name William among both Mulder and Scully's families, because my family has multiple members named Emily, Maggie, and Brad, and nearly every male relative has the middle name David. It's real.
Yeah. Jeez. That's what I have to like say all the time. They're like, is this really like something that people think is strange that family members are named the same thing? And that
it's still a bee in my bonnet. I know that family members are named the same, but I think like fiction should be better than real life in that respect, because that is real life. But Fiction should make it easier for me to tell the characters apart than real life does. I shouldn't have to keep track of two people with the same name when they are picking the names for them. And Emily also adds on later in a later tweet following our conversation with Pat, the X-Files is obsessed with sibling relationships, and I'm not sure we talk about it enough. I have no further thesis at this time, but I think it's a thing. I think it's a thing too, actually, Emily. I think that's a really great point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether it's Mulder's relationship with Samantha or Scully's relationship with her brothers, it is very interesting, and it does come up a lot, and it is an important part of the show. So we should talk about that more, and I think I'm sure that we will. So great insight, Emily, and great insight from everybody. Thank you very much for sending tweets. Did you have anything else you wanted to say in response to that, Annie?
Not really, just another thank you to Pat for joining us. I mean, that was such a fun conversation to have, and I'm really grateful that we were able to have it.
Great. It's just wonderful how these things just kind of magically come to pass sometimes, and we appreciate it when it happens. So thank you very much again, Pat, for joining us. Thank you, everyone, for listening and for tweeting as well. And if you would like to tweet at us, please do so at XFD Podcast on Twitter, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
Anasazi, season 2. Finale.
Yes.
I always think of this episode as later. Like, I know it's the season 2 finale, but it feels like season 3 to me.
I know. A lot of times when I go looking for it, I look for it in season 3.
Yeah.
I often forget it. It's that early because it's so well formed.
Absolutely. It's great. And it's one of those, again, I feel it reminds me of like Little Green Men in that I know it's a good episode. Like, I inherently know that. But then every time I watch it, I'm like, damn, this is good. Like, it reminds me of how good it is. And I mean, this is really fantastic. Directed by R.W. Goodwin, you know, one of our frequent flyers here. Yep. And the story is by David Duchovny and Chris Carter. Again. And teleplay by Chris Carter. Yeah. This season, all the way, it's worth pointing out, 25 episodes, Jen. That's insane. That's like,
yeah, I know. The fact that this is the 25th episode is like, wow, they were just hammering it out in season 2, and they put out some amazing episodes.
Yeah, it is real. I mean, there are some clunkers in season 2, but what are you going to expect when you put out 25 hours of television? Honestly. So many of them are phenomenal hours of television. And so
and huge undertakings.
Yeah. Yeah, they're like, I mean, I know Duchovny's been on record saying that like each one was just essentially like a tiny movie. And so it's like they're filming 25 movies in less than a year. I mean, it's insane. It's insane. But let's get into this, shall we? We have a lot to cover tonight. So Anasazi is the first time we are in New Mexico, but it won't be the last. We do return to New Mexico more, but notably, and I will probably come back to this tonight, in The Truth, the very last episode of the original run is we're in New Mexico. So just wanted to bring that up. I know people remember, but I like to bring things up whenever there's a cool little connection.
I don't always remember, so I appreciate it.
Yeah. So we start out with an earthquake, which is really cool because it occurs to me, too, there are so many little things that lead to other things that, like, obviously the earthquake has shaken loose this boxcar to be revealed.
Right.
And I love that line Albert has that's like, the earth is telling a secret, or he says something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. He has some very cool things to say about that.
Yeah. And so we should give Floyd Red Crow Westerman a shout out because is this his first episode? I know we've talked about him.
I believe it is.
Yeah, we talked about him recently, but it was on our guest star episode. So this is the first time we're talking about him in the context of the story. And so, what a great character, right?
Yeah, like, he comes right in and, man, he just like takes over. He's so amazing on screen and so well cast, and he's just so great. And I wrote down in my notes, I buy anything he's selling. Like, he says some weird ass stuff in this episode, but I'm just kind of like, sure, Albert, makes sense to me. I'm going with it. He's just so great.
I do enjoy that, like, we get him in this arc, and then we get him again later in the Biogenesis arc, which also involves a secret coming up from the earth, essentially. Yeah. Which is a really nice parallel. I did like what he said when first of all, shout out to me because this kid on the motorbike is named Eric, which is my husband's name. So clearly, nice. Even though I wasn't watching the show and had not met my husband, clearly that was intended as a shout out for me. So
I can only assume that it was.
Exactly. So
perfect. But, well done. Kudos.
I do love his line when he says, "Leave the snakes alone. They'll be angry." And everything, you know, has a meaning. Like everything has a little bit of an underlying symbolism.
Absolutely.
And I took that to mean that this was kind of pointing at Smoking Man, because this is one of the very rare moments. And we don't get there till like a little later, although we get a little bit of it in this episode. But like where Smoking Man like loses his shit, like he gets mad.
Yep.
He seems out of control, you know, which is very rare for him.
He does not cope well with not being in control because he's used to being in control all the time.
No. And I don't know if that was intended, but I always like to think that these things are. And so I really just leave the snakes alone. They'll be angry. It made me think of like Smoking Man is like a snake and he's very angry. Anyway,
I like that. And I like the fact that he says they'll be angry and afraid, which I think is interesting because I think that's a perfect description of CSM, actually, when you think about it, especially in this episode is, he is angry, but he is afraid. And whenever he's acting out and being a little bit more sort of like emotional and aggressive, it's you can always kind of sense it's coming from a place of fear that he does fear the loss of control. So I think that's everything that Albert Hostein says sounds like a poem to me. And that's just one of them.
I love him. And there's a reason he's my favorite actor, like or one of my favorite guest actors on this is because I think he plays that part so perfectly. I enjoy every second that he's on screen. I wish he was on this show more. I really do.
Yeah, that he's amazing. I'm really glad you picked him as one of your favorite guest stars because I didn't think of it at the time. But rewatching this, I'm like, yes, he just has it, right? He's just got that on-screen charisma and he just like doesn't seem like he's acting. He just seems like a very authentic.
Yes.
And that's hard to find in an actor, I think. So he's amazing.
Really, really great description. So I have a question about this boxcar. And we're going to be talking a lot about boxcars in the coming months because the boxcars come back in Nisei 731. Yep. The boxcars come back in, I think it's Two Fathers, One Son. So we these are definitely the boxcars are definitely.
I love the boxcars.
They're definitely an ongoing
theme. I just have a thing for trains of any kind, and the boxcars are cool.
Yeah, but I like the idea that like these are these mobile rooms where they can do these alien autopsies and all these experiments, and where they took Scully allegedly. All of these other we'll talk about that much later, but. My question to you, Jen, is how did the boxcar get there?
Fair question. Why is the boxcar in the earth?
Yeah. Like,
and how is the boxcar in the earth? First of all, sort of out of universe for a second, did my little, 15-minute Wikipedia page research on this episode today, and they like trucked away, like, I can't remember how much it was, but like an enormous amount of earth in the production of this episode just to be able to bear. I guess they must have actually buried something of a boxcar.
They would
to
have
be
had
able to pull this off. So that just tells you how hard it is to actually bury a boxcar. So I am assuming that it was the experiments were somehow done. They wanted to hide these bodies. And instead of doing something sensible like burn it, which is what they finally eventually did.
Right.
But that for whatever reason, they thought the safest and most secret thing we can do is take this entire boxcar, not just the bodies, but the whole boxcar.
Yeah.
And go to the sort of, somewhere relatively isolated in New Mexico, but clearly somewhere near where people are living.
Yeah.
And just bury the whole damn boxcar, which I would have thought would have attracted a whole hell of a lot of attention, but I guess they got away with it at the time. Maybe the folks that live there now had not settled in that area at that point. I don't know.
Right.
But it seems like a weird idea to bury the entire boxcar, not just the evidence contained therein, unless they just thought, fuck it, let's just bury the whole boxcar. That'll just be easier somehow. I mean, it makes for a cool image and, if just the bodies had suddenly appeared, that would have taken away from a lot of the sort of events of the episode.
Yeah.
It doesn't make a whole lot of logical sense why you'd bury the whole boxcar. That would be a lot of work. But I'm assuming at one point it was buried really deep. I'm going to guess, strictly guessing, that maybe it took several earthquakes before it finally came to the surface. I sure hope they had it buried more deeply than it appeared it was in this episode, because it looks like it was only a few feet down, and all it took was some mild disturbance, and there it suddenly is.
Yeah.
I'm assuming maybe just over the years,
there were
earthquakes, and eventually, here it is.
I think that, and it almost feels like, you know, kismet, like the timing, that here we go, right when Mulder is, like, out and about doing his thing. Yeah. We got the boxcar. We got
And what about the weird coincidence, unless it isn't, but I can't think of anything that would tie them together, of the fact that Albert Hochstein is a code talker, a Navajo code talker, which is key to understanding the UFO documents, and also this boxcar full of evidence happens to have been buried relatively close to where he winds up living.
Okay, well, I thought the same thing, Jen. And I was wondering if perhaps it wasn't an accident. Because I feel like the entire time Albert Hochstein is very mysterious. We do find out later that he actually was the one who encrypted these files. So he is well aware of what these files say. He is one of the people who is privy to the truth. He knows everything. And so that makes me think that perhaps he's there by design. Maybe he's watching over it. Maybe he's aware that the boxcar is there. Maybe that is in the documents. And that's why he knows so much. And I was just kind of thinking this out backwards and like going, maybe it isn't a coincidence. Maybe he's there on purpose because he's sort of protecting that area. And he knows, like... He, for some reason, he knows, like, the Earth has a secret that it needs to tell. Like, he's like, now is the time. It's been decades, but this secret is finally coming to light. It doesn't bother me as, like, a continuity or, like, a, wow, that's real lucky issue, so much as it just kind of leads to more questions. And it leads me to go, how much does he know? And how much has he been hiding? Which makes it, you know, probably out of fear. I'm not suggesting that he's like part of the syndicate or anything, but like,
No.
But like he clearly knows a lot. So I just find that really interesting. And it's cool.
Yeah. I think that's a very good explanation. And I think most of the time when I've watched Anasazi, I have some vague idea in the back of my mind without actually thinking too hard about it, that it's probably something like that. But it was only when I started thinking about it sort of more sort of critically that I thought, wait a second, how does this work? But I think you're right that it's not a coincidence that there is some kind of a connection between the two. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't necessarily have to know exactly how that came to pass, but I think we have to believe that there must be some connection between them. Either that or he's just, you know, a very strangely lucky and prescient fellow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm saying that the connection is that he knows he encrypted the documents. So,
yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, too. There's just another cool parallel. We were already talking about all the boxcars throughout the series, but they burn, you know, at one point when Smoky Man says burn it and they burn the boxcar. They did the same thing in One Son when they had, you know, I don't remember if the rebel, I'm trying to remember. I haven't seen that one in a while. If the rebel aliens are the ones who burned it, I think they did.
We'll talk about it when we get there.
Yeah, but it was just kind of another cool parallel of like a burning boxcar. Like, we're going to do that again.
Burn the boxcars!
Yeah. And so Eric takes this body, right? He somehow extracts a body from the boxcar.
Yeah, somehow, I guess, at the very beginning, he must have gotten into the boxcar, got a body, got it out, took it back to show everyone.
To show everyone. And then I think at that point, Albert Hochstein was probably just piecing everything together. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Okay. That, all of that, is just the cold open. Wow.
Honestly, right?
Tuck in, guys. Tuck in. So after the cold open, we are back with Kenneth Suna, who we have heard his name before. Jen, do you remember where we have heard of the thinker?
Yeah. Was it in One Breath?
It was in One Breath. He's the one who was aware. Oh, good job. Good job.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Paying attention. I love it.
Yeah, good job.
He's the one who was aware of like what the branch DNA was in Scully's blood. And Byers was, I think, sort of dictating what he had said about it or something. He wasn't actually in the episode, but they mentioned him.
Byers kind of just, or one of them, kind of described the Thinker as like the fourth lone gunman or something at the time. They don't really describe him quite the same way in this episode.
Yeah,
but
I feel like
there's obviously a connection between them.
It seemed like maybe they were like attempting to recruit him and then were like, nah. that's going to be my headcanon. They were like, he's too stupid. He's not taking precautions. He's just like dicking around on the internet, like hacking into the DOD.
Would be probably pretty sensible.
Yeah, he got in, so that's good. But if you're going to get chased and killed, then, you know, you're not good. That's not so good.
Yeah, and they kind of emphasize what an anarchist he is. Mm-hmm. And so, like, he's just hard to handle and all he wants is chaos. So that's too much for them.
But it's funny to me because this character, when we do actually meet him, doesn't strike me as that, which I thought was
very anarchistic, does he?
No, he seems just like kind of a terrified nerd most anarchists are. Like, I feel like this is almost a commentary on like all these people that like you're afraid of, like there's this anarchist, they're trying to cause all this drama. No, he's just a guy. He's just trying to get to the truth, you know? I liked it. I don't know if it was intentional or if this was a casting choice, but like the guy did not come across as an anarchist to me.
He's very chill.
Yeah,
he's a very chill guy.
I mean, he's chill in this scene. And then later when he meets Mulder, he seems
sort of, you know, that's just like, he just seems like the kind of guy that just kind of, you know, he does a lot of shady shit on the down low, but like he's not one to get like super hyped up. Like you think about the lone gunman, they're always just a little wired.
Yeah.
But he's not like that at all.
Right. And also, this could be us just sort of misappropriating the word anarchist, like to think that, oh, this is just some crazy guy who wants to be like, and cause chaos, because that's the image in my mind when I hear the word anarchist. But
I picture someone just looking a little bit more out there, like
scary,
maybe like a mohawk and a lot more piercings or something like that.
Yeah, and someone who like screams a lot. I don't know, like I just like causing chaos and distress and sowing discord.
But very, you know, quiet, easygoing people can want anarchy too. So I think this is probably pretty accurate.
Yeah, yeah. I just thought it was kind of a funny, interesting casting choice. But I wanted to point out this book that he's reading, which is called The 50 Greatest Conspiracies of All Time.
I don't think people read a lot of conspiracy books anymore. I think it would most likely be more of an internet experience. But the idea that that people in the 90s sat around reading books about conspiracies, I totally buy, because, you know, the internet wasn't much of a thing at that point. And so, yes, we were all having to make do with our conspiracy books instead of, you know, these days it's like a new conspiracy every hour. So think about the idea of conspiracies like being sort of stable enough to actually make it into a book that gets read is kind of a funny idea. But conspiracies were very different back then. They did tend to not change every hour with every crazy theory. They tended to be kind of well thought out, well researched concepts.
Right.
Even if they were a little bit wackadoodle, they tended to be things that people devoted a lot of time and energy to.
And people were relatively sort of quiet about them. Like, some conspiracy theorists were loud, but a lot of the time it was kind of a taboo subject. Like, oh, I'm not going to talk about this with you unless I feel safe talking about it. Whereas now the president yells about conspiracy theories. So it's cool now. It's okay to just shout about stuff that's not proven.
Yeah. It's very different. Yeah, it's one of the things when you watch The X-Files, how different conspiracy theorists and conspiracies are regarded now in sort of our milieu of today versus how it was experienced back in the 90s. Because you're right, in the 90s, it was very much, you know, under the radar, just these kind of weird underground nerd types that were kind of into conspiracies. There was no real politicization of them at all. There was just this sense of all government was not to be trusted. It doesn't matter which party or anything like that. It was just governments in general were not trustworthy. Whereas it's become very politicized since then, and conspiracy theories have a whole different sort of implication and connotation. But back in the 90s, they were thought of differently.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they got to play with that quite a bit in the revival, which I really appreciated.
Like, yeah.
They actually, I mean, if anyone's going to point that out, the actual X-Files should, and they did. And I think that's really great of them to have done.
I think that was one of the great strengths of the revival, the fact that they could kind of revisit the concept of conspiracy theories and how much that it had changed.
Absolutely. Definitely. So this scene coming up here when there so much happens in like 30 seconds. It's like you get the call to all of these different countries. It's like this phone chain of like, someone broke into the MJ documents. And then, you know, everyone's like, did they take care of it? And it's like they all kind of know. They know exactly what the MJ documents are, and they know this is a big deal.
They look alarmed.
Yeah, and then obviously we find out later that essentially, you know, to sort of simplify, round down, essentially the MJ documents are the documents, like the proof of alien life with everything they've been doing since Roswell. Presumably the documents that like the president is given and debriefed with every time a new president, you know, the quote unquote conspiracy. I love the idea that we get so worldly so quickly in this episode. It's like we are actually being passed around the globe, and everyone is passing the buck. Everyone is like, nope, they have to take care of it. Like this happened. It's very in line with their whole, If an EBE is found in your country, it's your responsibility to destroy it, which is also another thing that carries through from what, Deep Throat or whatever, all the way to the revival. So that's another cool little bit. But I liked this, that they were like, no, you got to take care of it. And then, of course, we end up with Smoky Man. Of course, we're back on the Smoky Man. And he straight up lies to them.
he's such a poker player, isn't he? I'm totally on top of this.
How many things does this guy say that is actually true? Like, I feel like somebody should sort of keep a tally. I feel like that's something that's possible, because he's not in a lot of episodes. Like, you know, everything the guy says is a freaking lie. Anyway, he's like,
and he does it pretty effectively. He's very effectively. He's like a cool liar.
He's like, I'm got it, I'm taking care of it. But then he hangs up and he goes, that was the phone call I never wanted to get, which I thought was a really great line.
It's such a contrast from how cool he's on the phone. Like, yeah, done, taken care of. We're fine with it. And then as soon as he hangs up, it's like, oh God, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he knows that they're going to have to take care of it. And he's like, all right, well, I haven't yet, but I will. I have every confidence in myself.
I mean, which of us in the workplace has not at some point said to our boss, oh yeah, no, I definitely sent that email, and then scurried back to our desk and sent the email? So
exactly.
That's kind of what Cancer Man's doing here.
I actually really love that idea. totally. Then you see everyone breaking into the apartment, the Thinker's apartment. And this scene, I never had this thought before, Jen, but this scene reminded me so much of this. The scene where they're breaking in after, you know, after Mulder and Scully like are trying to talk them down or talk to them, and they get broken in, and then they're like looking in and they're trying to like break his phone and get onto his computer. I don't know. It just reminded me very much of that scene.
Yeah, that kind of like all these sort of, you know, black ops guys coming in and then doing techie stuff when they get in there. Like, they look like they're about to go in and just shoot the place up, and he just sits down at the computer and starts typing. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, but
it's very much like what they do in this as well.
Yeah, I didn't actually like watch those scenes side by side, but I have watched this like an uncomfortably embarrassing amount of times. And so it just brought that into my head immediately. But
yeah, no, good comparison.
All right, finally, here we are, Jen, 23 minutes into this, and we're getting to Mulder. Yay!
Right? There's so much. But, you know, sometimes in The X-Files, if we don't get a sufficient amount of Mulder and Scully in the first few minutes, I'm like, where's Mulder and Scully? I'm bored. But never in NSIZ. Just like every scene is just gripping to me. So, yeah I don't miss them at all.
This is a very, you know, we talked before about how Fight the Future was just very poorly paced at the beginning.
Oh, right.
This is, they should have taken their cue from this, because this
is how you do it.
This was very well paced. I mean, and I don't know the exact time code when we actually first see Mulder, but it's just a very well paced episode. I love it.
There's a lot crammed in, but it never feels rushed, and it does just move. It moves along at a really fast pace, but I never feel like I get left behind or anything like that. It's just a very, very well constructed episode.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we now see Mulder in his blue tank top, which, thank you, costume department. We never see it again, but we...
I don't think we do we? Yeah, I wrote down in my notes, look at Mulder in his little tank top. So cute.
My notes say, Mulder, sick and cranky, but hot. And
all true.
Right? And I mean, I wanted to say that, like, Anasazi could have been renamed Mulder's worst day ever. Mulder and the terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. Because that's essentially what this is. This is
it
like...
It kind of is, actually. You're right.
It's his... Like, literally everything happens to him in this episode. Like, he gets in trouble with at work. He gets sick. He gets shot. His dad dies. And he dies, quote unquote, at the end of it. Like, it's seriously, it's the worst episode for him ever.
It's a really, really bad day for Mulder. Or a bad couple of days. But I will also point out at the same time, and we'll see this in our ongoing discussion, that to me, everything that actually happens in this episode is because of Scully. So everything is happening to Mulder. Mm-hmm. But everything is happening because of Scully. All the good stuff, all the progress.
You mean, everything's she's figuring everything out. Yeah,
she does everything in this episode. And
yeah.
So we'll see this as we talk more about it. But I just want to flag Scully from the beginning because she's so badass in this episode.
She really is. I wrote that in here several times. Like, Scully figuring it out again. Scully figuring it out again. Like, she literally does everything. And I mean, you can't blame Mulder. He's being like, he's kind of being like a whiny bitch baby throughout this entire episode. Yeah. But like, you can't blame him. The guy's been drugged. So
yeah. I mean, Scully clearly doesn't blame him. She just lets it roll right off her. She knows it's not the real Mulder, and so we shall do the same.
Exactly. Exactly. So the gunmen show up. We always love to see the gunmen.
We always love to see the gunmen.
But Mulder does not love to see the gunmen. He is not in a good mood. He is PMSing hard. He does not want them in his apartment. You can tell he's not well, though. Like, I do like the plant from the beginning that, like, you can tell he's not feeling well. He's sick. And we don't really have to deal with that until much later into the episode, but it is planted very early, which I like.
And they do show the glass of water at the very beginning, although it's ostensibly because he's taking a couple of aspirin. Mm-hmm. But I do like the fact that they find an excuse to fit a glass of water right from the beginning of that scene. He's you know, getting a glass of water from the tap. So, you know, looking back on it, foreshadowing a plenty, but it doesn't stand out at the time, which is very cleverly done.
And I love those things because I feel like shots like that are sort of, and I don't even know if Vince Gilligan was Vince Gilligan working at this point?
I feel like this is pre-Vince Gilligan.
This is pre-Vince Gilligan, but I feel like that's one of the things that he learned from the X-Files and carried on through to Breaking Bad was this concept of showing a sort of innocuous object and that's very important. But then later coming back to it and realizing, wow, that was a lot more important than I realized. I always think that when I used to watch Breaking Bad, that these were the things that he brought with him from the X-Files. Because the X-Files always does that really well.
It does it really well. And it doesn't work if it stands out too much the first time they introduce that thing. So you've got to do it the right way. And they definitely do it the right way here for sure.
Yeah. So that's a great example of that. I like the continuity. You know me, I'm always trying to bring up the good continuity.
Love it.
That obviously all these files were taken from the DOD. That never changes. The Department of Defense, the military, is always sort of the bad guy in this throughout the series, throughout the X-Files, which is where all the secrets are kept, which is great. And I like that that's consistent. But I do want to say, like, a lot of this scene, which is... it's an odd scene. It's strange because the gunmen are there. They're telling him all this stuff. There's a gunshot. Mulder runs around the corner and suddenly, like, the cops are there. Everybody knows what's happening. And literally 7 seconds have passed since the gunshot.
Really? Wow. That's an amazing response.
Yeah. So every time, and I know they just are doing this for drama's sake, so we can forgive the show that. But every time I'm just like, how are the cops there? Like, how does this lady already know the entire backstory? It's like the gunshot happened and then Mulder is suddenly at the scene, whereas it should be like 15 minutes later. I bump on that every single time.
I've never noticed it, but I will now.
You know me, I always like pointing out the little things that irritate me as well. But
all I'm ever doing during that whole part is just, I have a thing about Mulder in his tank top running with his gun. He just looks very hot, and that's, I'm very distracted by that, and so that just glosses right over any logistical issues for me.
It makes up for it, you know.
It works,
and I cannot blame you, Jen, because I feel like I have been distracted in the past, but this, I bump on this, it bothers me.
Fair enough.
It's just for the sake of drama, so let's just wave that away. But I think this whole scene is just really weird. Well, we find out that the woman has shot her husband. Which we later realize is because they've been drinking the crazy water, literally.
Yeah, that's which, just kind of, doesn't that suck, though, that all yeah. these poor unfortunate sort of collateral damage, this poor woman shoots her husband and he's dead and she's got to live with that and it's all just because they were after Mulder.
Yeah, I mean, and it looks, and when you put it that way, it makes me feel bad. It makes Mulder probably feel really bad, but it's just, it's not necessarily like because they're after Mulder. I mean, I feel like this is just a small microcosm of like the actual collateral damage that they're, that the syndicate's work and the bad guys' yeah. work has on the American people. And this is just another example of it.
They don't care. As Scully says later on, it wasn't an exercise in subtlety.
Exactly.
It's just like, you know, this is not a surgical strike. They can't be bothered. They don't care how many people they take down. It doesn't matter to them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like at a certain point that's actually explicitly stated. I'm sure we'll get to it. But I that sounds very familiar. Like they actually discuss this. You know, Scully says over and over, there's no justice. I mean, it's just, this is the kind of thing that happens. So anyway, so we have our next scene, I believe, is when Mulder is meeting up with the Thinker.
Yeah.
Right. I have my notes are so sort of like scattered and crazy, but
there's just a lot happening here.
It's so much. It's so much.
it's just, we're all over the place.
Yeah. I
think that is the next one.
Yeah. I have written here a line that Mulder says, but now I don't know what he says it in response to. It's the Mulder line where he says, sounds like a line I used in a bar once.
Oh yeah. When the Thinker says,
oh, I don't want to tell you my name.
I don't want to give you my name. I just don't think you need to know it or something like that. I love it. I love that. That's a funny joke. That's a very funny joke.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, this leads into the next inevitable question. Do you think Mulder used that in a bar once, or is he just being Mulder and making a joke?
I think he's just being Mulder making a joke, probably, but it's probably the kind of thing he's thought about doing.
Exactly. I just think it's cute. It's very on par with Mulder. It just sounds very Mulder humor.
It's it's times like that I can kind of maybe see something of the David Duchovny influence on the story. I'm very curious exactly what input David Duchovny provided to this story, because, you know, he gets that sort of co-credit for story by, which could mean anything, really. So I am very curious. But it definitely is a great Mulder episode in the sense that he feels very in character the whole time, even though this is like, you know, he's obviously being crazified by the water. But he's also very Mulder at the same time. And that line is, very classic Mulder.
This is, and I think, too, like you said, Duchovny having input in the script, I think, led to this. But this is a very good showcase for Mulder, this episode. I mean, there's a lot of great Mulder stuff in here. And he does seem very tapped into this character. So I think that absolutely added to it and made it better. So well spotted.
And great for Chris Carter to kind of, this is the only one two seasons in, to kind of, you know, have the recognition of the contribution that David Duchovny can make, that he was open to Duchovny's contributions to the story. So good for him for recognizing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he was actually very open in general to a lot. I mean, just to open his story up to so many different writers. You know, unfortunately, not very, very many women until much later. But I don't necessarily think that's a Chris Carter problem so much as a 90s problem. But he was very open to other writers' input while maintaining control over the show, and I think that's definitely to be commended. So
agreed.
I thought that the last thing I wanted to point out about this scene, which is funny, that the Thinker says, I want the truth, and I want you to promise that those rat bastards answer to the people. I just think it's very funny that rat is mentioned in the episode that we finally are reintroduced to Krycek again.
I've never made that connection, and I'm surprised I haven't. Because,
I hadn't either, but I did this time, and I just wanted to point it out because as soon as I hear rat, I always think of Krycek. So
yeah, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone does, really. I'm surprised I've never seen that in the world of fandom. No one's ever made that connection, because there's a lot of folks that are big Krycek fans out there. Yeah. So kudos. Maybe someone else has made that connection, but
maybe they have, but I have never heard it. So
no. Well done.
So my next thing is, it's clearly making fun of Mulder. I do not think this is out of character for Mulder, because occasionally Mulder can be stupid. But why is he looking at the tape at work. Like, it's
Government computer.
On a government computer where everyone's monitoring what he's doing all the time. Like, he knows this guy has hacked into the DOD and he's got these files. And he's so eager to look at these files. Like, I would expect him to, like, call the lone gunman, maybe, or do something else. But
that,
like,
makes sense. You go straight to the gunman.
You look in your office, Jen, where there's IT guys watching over your shoulder. That's where you look at the top secret documents, right?
Well, my headcanon is that he really, really wanted his girlfriend to be there with him when he looked at it. And he's pretty damn excited when Scully shows up. Come in and close the door.
I think you're right. I think he wanted to have it there so that she could see it. Because I think at the end of the day, Mulder really wants the truth, but he also just really wants Scully to see it. So I like that. And like I said, I don't
share that magical moment with her.
Exactly. And I don't.
He clearly hadn't even looked at it yet by the time.
No, he was confident. He was there. Yeah.
He had not seen it at all. And shout out to the 90s use of cassette tape for storing data on, because that is something that definitely is not done anymore, but was very common at the time.
Yeah. Yep. Anyway, I just wanted to point that out because I find that really funny. But of course, he comes up, you know, he's a boy, so he jumps to conclusions and gets angry and starts kicking things. Not to be sexist, but it's true. And Scully's like, hold up. It's not gibberish. It's actually Navajo. And I love this, Jen. This is one of those moments that I'm like, well, of course Scully knows. But I'm like, no. She knows because she's an army brat. Like, she would know. And it's such a cool little connection. It's, like, he needs her to figure this out. Like, the two of them together. Yeah. If Scully weren't there, Mulder would have had his little hissy fit. And then this tape would have disappeared and he would have thought about it again.
End of the episode.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But she just happens to know Navajo. And it's not, like you say, it's not just one of those ridiculous, like, come on. Like, you know, how perfect does Scully have to be that she just happens to know Navajo?
Yeah.
But no, they do have like a little backstory explaining why. And it makes total sense.
Yeah.
Because we know that, you know, that her dad was in the Navy. And so he's a military guy. And it does make sense that he would know this sort of thing and that and that she'd be into it because she's, you know, she was, I'm sure, a smart young lady. And so it would be the kind of thing they might talk about. Totally, totally believable in character.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I just love it that she knows it and she just calmly and quietly explains to him this is Navajo.
Yeah. And again, like, I wanted to, like, lash out at Mulder for being a little baby. But again, I also have to kind of chalk it up to he's, like, under the influence and he's reacting violently, which is not like him. And
Scully recognizes that right away in that scene. She's like, hey, are you okay? She already knows him well enough to know that. And he's not acting that odd in that one scene. He's obviously, you know, acting up a bit because we know why. But if we had just, you know, come upon him in that scene, it wouldn't seem terribly out of character.
Right.
But Scully knows right away that there's something up.
Yeah, I do love that about her. It's like, it's enough for her to know. And that's really great. And she asks him that, I think, another time in this episode, and she definitely asks him that repeatedly throughout the series. It's like every time Scully asks Mulder if he's okay, take a drink. It's literally like she's always checking in on him, and I love it. It makes me soft. So Skinner, I had to bring up this scene with Skinner because obviously, well, for obvious reasons, but this should have been a clue to Mulder right away that Skinner was working with Smoking Man, right? Because Skinner says, there's been some rumors that you have heard about this or that you have possession of this tape or whatever he says. And I was immediately going, huh, Skinner, no, what the heck? What is going on? And you would think that Mulder would have put that together, but like, he doesn't seem super suspicious of Skinner. Even like up through Redux, I remember when Scully is telling him like, he's dirty and Mulder's like, no, not Skinner. And I just love that, like, Mulder, it doesn't matter. Like, he still trusts Skinner, even though we know that Skinner is, like, a double agent at this point, you know?
Yeah. I think that Mulder maybe kind of sort of thinks that maybe that Skinner's loyalties are split. And I think there's lots of ways he would know about the acquisition of these hacked documents. I mean, the Department of Defense might have alerted some kind of a chain in the government that led to Skinner. So it doesn't necessarily have to have come via CSM, although, Mulder knows there's some kind of connection between the two. He's known that, I think, all along. But I think he knows also that Skinner's not necessarily one of them, but that there's some kind of a connection. So I don't think it would shock Mulder to find that out. But I think he still trusts Skinner quite a lot. We see that. We saw that in Colony and Endgame as well.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously he knows that Skinner knows Smoking Man because he's seen him in the office before. But like this will be interesting as we continue through these mythology episodes as to like where the trust between Mulder and Skinner ebbs and flows.
Yeah. I mean, I love the sort of relationship between Mulder and Scully and Skinner and the sort of the relationship Skinner has with each of them.
Yeah.
And I find that really interesting. And I absolutely agree. It's going to be interesting to see how it develops over the course, particularly of mythology, which is where we usually see him and sort of culminating to him becoming like really Scully's strongest ally in season 8. And that's one of the things that I love about season 8. So
yeah, it's absolutely.
Him and Scully together, magical combination for me. So yeah, no, I love anything like that.
Yeah. And I mean, clearly in this, I think this scene is so funny because Mulder is clearly going to be bested by Skinner. I mean, Skinner's a boxer. Yeah. He's bigger than Mulder. It's like trying to beat up the class bully. It's like, it's not going to end well for you.
Skinner,
Mulder
just takes care of business, doesn't he? His glasses go off and man, he's ready to take Mulder down. He doesn't want Mulder to just be restrained and let's end this fight. No, he wants to show Mulder, you did not get the better of me, dude. I am taking you down. And he does it pretty effectively, and it's pretty hot.
It is. And at the same time, though, like, he also doesn't want to, like, really injure Mulder, which I think he easily could. And quickly tries to sort of de-escalate, which I appreciate from Skinner. I do like this scene with Scully and the little Chris Carter cameo coming up. Where Scully, her face is so funny. It's literally like, oh God, I gotta explain for my boyfriend again. What has he done this time? Like, it's so resigned. And we're only like two seasons into this. It's just,
honestly,
it's so
like
funny.
She's already at that point. But she's like, what's he done now?
I do think it's funny too how the line that Chris Carter gave himself is like,
yeah,
and he's your partner. And he says, or something about your partner, and he says it so skeptically. And I think that's like the funniest sort of trolly line that he could possibly have given himself, considering like his role in the fandom. Like, I had to point that out because I think it's so funny.
Yeah, it is an interesting choice. I mean, it's interesting to sort of, you know, pop himself into that scene and not just as someone, you know, walking by in the background. He's got lines and everything. They had to get him in costume and makeup and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he does a pretty good job, actually.
I just think it's funny how the guy's like, do you think Agent Mulder confides in you? She goes, of course, he's my partner. Then Chris Carter goes, your partner. I don't know. I always just think it's very funny.
It's a good point. Yes.
I'm going to move on to Bill Mulder, but is there anything that we haven't covered so far that you wanted to address?
No, I think we've covered everything really well.
All right. Just making sure. I didn't want you to fall behind if you've got stuff on your notes.
I'm with you. Let's move on to Bill Mulder. I'm ready to go.
All right. So we're in West Tisbury, Martha's Vineyard. And last time we met Bill Mulder, things did not end very well. He and Mulder did not part well at all. And, so I just find this whole everything about Bill Mulder in this scene or in this episode, I should say, sort of kind of breaks my heart, especially knowing everything that comes later. And trust me, I don't think Bill Mulder is like entirely a victim. I do not think that. He definitely made choices. He was involved. But I do think he much like Tina Mulder, much like many of these characters, is at times slightly misunderstood, because I do feel like he was in an impossible position at a certain point. These men are doing these awful things, but he does tell Mulder, like, he respects him. You didn't throw in, you know, eventually he'll say that. And we find out later that, like, Bill Mulder didn't really throw in either. Like, he was the lone dissenter. Like, he was the one in the syndicate that was like, no, we need to do our best to save the public. Like, we need to do our best to do this vaccine. He was the one person trying to do that, and he didn't necessarily succeed before he decided to just leave. And that's another kind of mystery that we never really know how Bill Mulder exactly got out of the syndicate. Like, did he just leave? What happened? Like, and I think that's just fascinating to me. Like, his relationship with the group and how he got out and why he got out, I find really fascinating. But
yeah.
Anyway, Smoking Man visits Bill Mulder. And this is, I think, the first time we've seen the two of them even interacting, right? At this time, when you were first watching this episode, like, was this a shock to you? Like, I'm trying to... Yeah, okay.
It was. I can quite clearly recall, actually, when Bill Mulder is going to answer the door. And I love the way it's shot, that it's that kind of glass. You can't quite see who's behind it, but you can just see someone's there. And at the time, I was sure it was going to be Mulder.
Yeah.
And when you open up the door and it was CSM, I was like, shock! So, yeah, to me, it was very shocking. That was like just one of many shocking developments in Anasazi. So, yeah, for sure, it was a shock.
So the idea, and again, like, I'm just kind of trying to get everything straight, too, because, I mean, I knew so much already before I went back and watched these episodes, you know, so this was the first time we knew for sure that Bill Mulder was actually part of the syndicate, correct?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything prior to that, because I was thinking the same thing, because my brain is kind of scrambled now, too. But my recollection is that I don't think we do know anything about him in connection with the syndicate at that point, because I do remember it being surprising. And they do kind of do it as this kind of like reveal.
Yeah.
So I think that is the first time that it's indicated.
And certainly in Colony, like by the time they were filming Colony, they would have been writing this. So it makes me think that they kind of deliberately held back that information in Colony and kind of made him come across as sort of a oblivious kind of, whoa, I don't know what's going on. Like, your sister's here. How could you have done this to your sister? Whatever. I'm not saying that was a mistake, though. I mean, I think you can look back and you can see that he's clearly hiding something. But I just think it was an interesting choice to sort of, again, unravel the layers of Bill Mulder in this way. I think that was really cool. I do like how there was that giant American flag behind Smoking Man, too.
Isn't it a great shot? Yeah. Just that great shot when the door is open and there's CSM and the big American flag. It's just so well composed. I love that whole sequence.
Yeah. Yeah, you were about to say something when I brought up the flag. Do you remember?
No, I was just agreeing with you.
Oh, okay.
I think. Yeah.
I will. If it comes to you, you let me know.
I
like the little character, the establishment that, like, he's clearly a drunk. Like, he's got a drinking issue.
Yeah, he's drinking all the time in this.
Yeah, and his, you know, he looks a little jaundiced and his eyes are kind of crazy. Like, he looks like he has suffered the effects of alcoholism. And knowing what we know now, it isn't entirely surprising.
Yeah.
But I do think this is such an interesting detail, because I always sort of headcanon that Mulder does not drink. Like, he only drinks when he's like really depressed or he's like really thoughtful. Like, we see him drunk in Fight the Future. We see him drinking in Syzygy when he's obviously under the influence of craziness.
Yeah.
And I don't think we see him drinking again other than a beer here and there. Like, he'll have a beer.
I agree. He doesn't strike me as much of a drinker.
No, and I just find that
I don't think we see that.
I don't know if that's deliberate, but I like the idea that it is, because I would imagine his father drank, and it's the kind of thing that he just tried to stay away from because he didn't want to become that. I like that idea.
I think that makes total sense.
So Smoking Man has clearly not seen Bill in some time.
Yes.
And I know I feel like we've talked about this before and I'm already forgetting because it's just so much information, but I feel like we talked about, maybe it was in Fight the Future, that was what it was, when Mulder was talking to the well manicured man and he said something about like how his disillusionment outlasted mine. Which makes me think that like he quit, like Bill Mulder was somehow able to quit. So I don't know when that happened. Like I said, we still don't know. But I'm assuming that Bill has not seen Smoking Man since he left.
No, he seems really shocked and quite upset that CSM is there. He's kind of like, you know, you were never supposed to show up here kind of thing.
Right. And rightly so. Smoking Man says that the Thinker came forward, but let's be real, they probably just killed him.
Although they did get the information about the fact that he'd given it to Mulder. So maybe they tortured him and then killed him. That's what I'm picturing happening.
I have a feeling that they just got the information they needed and then just killed him. Which sounds.
Yeah. He came forward. That's just such a chilling kind of CSM style thing. The way, the way William B. Davis play CSM is, to me, so genius. Just the way he says that he can say that. And it's just like, oh, God, no. Instead of, like, if he had actually come right out and said, oh, we tortured him to get this information, it wouldn't seem nearly as scary as him just very coolly saying, oh, he came forward. It's like, oh, God, no.
Yeah, well, and I get the feeling that he's, I mean, we talk about how he lies all the time, but I get a feeling that he's a rather compulsive liar. And, I mean, it makes me think of Mulder saying, what was the one? I think it was in Redux that he says, to live the lie, you have to believe the lie, or something that. And I feel like Smoking Man has sort of talked himself into some of this stuff. Like, there's even that line, I feel like it maybe is in Musings of a Smoking Man, one of those episodes, where he says to Deep Throat, like, I'm not a murderer. Or he says something like that. And Deep Throat looks at him like, are you really that far gone? That you, like, and he says it with such conviction. And it's just a testimony to, like, this guy just... he deals in lies. I mean, Mulder says at a certain point he just deals in lies.
Yeah, I think I think you're right that he just convinces himself of a lot of things. Mm-hmm. He believes himself to be right at all times. He doesn't think of himself as a bad guy.
Right.
And so, and in order to do that, to sort of square that circle and kind of to sort of get past that cognitive dissonance of the bad things he's done, he just has to lie to himself a lot.
Yeah.
And one of those things is, I've never done any bad thing. And so I think he does, like, live the lie in a lot of ways. And that's why lying comes so easily to him. I suspect he can't even tell when he's doing it anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Agreed completely. Mm. I think it's an interesting moment when Bill Mulder brings up Mulder and like, are you kind of implying, like, are you going to kill him? Like, what's your plan? Yeah. And it's just so subtle, but there's, like, you can tell from that interaction that there's more to this story. And I'm not suggesting that they had at this point planned that, like, Mulder was not Bill's son, but we do know by season 3 that that's a possibility. So I think it's very possible that that was already kind of implanted.
I think that was definitely a possibility. I almost wonder if that was part of that shot that we were talking about when Bill opens up the door to see CSM there. As I said, I expected it to be Mulder, and I'm not sure if we were supposed to expect that, but expecting to see Mulder and then seeing CSM, and it kind of implanted in the back of my mind almost subconsciously that there's something connecting those two. And that might have been intentional. I don't know, but that's kind of how it feels to me.
Well, let me tell you, we're not there yet, but when we do get to Blessing Way, I have something that is hopefully going to blow everybody's mind.
So I look forward to that.
I look forward to sharing it with you.
Nice.
But he does say, I've protected him this long. And it feels honestly like they had some sort of, like, understanding between them. You know, I'm not exactly sure what that understanding was, but the idea, I'm thinking that maybe because we had to take Samantha, we're going to keep your other child safe. Some sort of understanding between them. I'm not sure. Or because maybe Bill knows that Smoking Man's his father. And they are kind of having this conversation within a conversation without actually saying what they're saying.
That is possible. I mean, CSM kind of ascribes it, as he often does, to, well, we can't kill him because, you know, we'll turn him into a martyr kind of thing. But it doesn't. It's, again, one of those things that it's hard to tell if that's really the truth or not. And just the phrase he uses, I've protected him this long, haven't I? Something about the haven't I implies this is something they've discussed before, like a long time ago, an agreement that they had reached. I kept up my end of the bargain is kind of how I read that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think too here, this is interesting. I mean, I don't think he's telling all the truth because he doesn't, but he does say to Bill, your son's been provident in alliances he's created, which I think as sort of a reason that he has kept him alive. And I think there are many reasons why Smoking Man has kept Mulder alive, maybe the primary one being that he knows he's his son. But I think that's an interesting, because, like, I feel like he's always telling everyone something slightly different, like why he's actually keeping Mulder alive.
Yeah.
He has so many different answers for that.
He does. Yeah.
Are all of them true or are none of them true? Like, you know, it's just,
he doesn't even know anymore.
Yeah, it's true. It's interesting. Yeah. And I do like that his advice to Bill Mulder is just the same thing that he does, is deny everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also interesting, you know, those parting words between CSM and Bill are interesting for a lot of reasons. And one of them is because when CSM says to Bill, you're your own man, Bill, that kind of sort of, to me, sends the message that he was kind of a dissenter in the group, and just sort of puts out that idea a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that last thing that CSM says, you look well. It just seems super threatening.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if he was like meaning that as a threat. Like, you know what I mean? Wink, wink. You look well. Wink, wink. I hope you stay that way. But it certainly feels very threatening.
Right. Especially since he like obviously looks the opposite of well. Yeah. Like this guy is not the like, poster child for well.
It is also possible he's being kind of snarky.
Yeah.
Like,
that's kind of well. Yeah. I like your idea that it's a threat because I think that it's his way of saying, stay in line, Bill, because
yeah,
if you don't,
took it.
Yeah, because, you know, obviously immediately he dispatches Krycek out here to keep an eye on him. I wonder if Smoking Man knows that Bill is about to confront Mulder.
I think he must suspect it.
Yeah, because, I mean, as far as Bill's concerned, this is out. Mulder's found it and he wants to be able to be the one to tell them the truth. I apologize for Leia. She's quite chatty if you're hearing her in the background.
Hi, Leia. Leia is just like very athletic. I'm just like so. I mean, I've only had dogs in the last several years of my life. It's been a long time since I've had a cat around. And I forgot how like amazingly good jumpers they are. Like Leia's just leaping gracefully onto the back of your chair there.
And
it's very impressive.
Is an old lady. She's like 16 years old.
She's not.
Yes.
She seems like a kitten.
No, she's small, but she's an old lady.
She's so perky.
She's very perky for an old lady.
I love her.
Mm-hmm.
She's
and
great.
Very spry.
That's nice. I can only aspire to the same.
All right. Well, moving on. We have Scully using her key. Right?
Yeah, right. She does have a key, doesn't she? I mean, I think
she does.
It looks to me like she does.
No,
yeah.
She absolutely does because they show us and it has like Mulder written on tape. Like it's her keys, his key, and then she has written Mulder on it. And might be in the blessing way that we see that. But that is canon. She has his key at this point. We're
it
in season
pretty
two.
Early on, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's got a key to his place.
Yeah, and I assume for, you know, worry being keeping each other safe, maybe feeding the fish, maybe doing things like that. I'm not sure, but I do wonder if Mulder has a key to her apartment because I don't know if we see him use it until like season 8. So,
well, she doesn't get in as much trouble as he does.
It's
so
true.
There's not as much reason for him to. She doesn't just, you know, run off to random places without telling him, for example. So,
right,
we
would have
had as much cause to. But it definitely shows like if someone has a key to your place, you are pretty close with that person. You're saying to that person, I rely on you more than anyone else.
Yep.
I don't have someone else to come and do these things. There's no one else that's going to come and check on me or do things when I'm away. You are the person I rely on in this world. And that's very special, I think.
It's very sweet.
I love it.
I love it. And I too, they don't make a big deal out of it either. It's just this kind of tiny little bit of information we get.
Yeah. And us shippers did not let it go by.
I guarantee you. I wouldn't have either.
Yeah.
Again, here we have Scully saying that she was worried about him. I was worried about you. Like, her motivation, I feel like so often is just making sure Mulder's okay. And I love that about their dynamic is like, especially like when he starts to kind of get very Mulder-y, she starts to get very worried and she doesn't feel, she can tell him that too. Like, I'm worried about you. Are you okay? I'm worried about how this is affecting you. Like, she says these things all the time, and I mean,
yeah,
I just
right from the beginning of their relationship she's done that, and she's not afraid to say it, and he desperately needs someone like that in his life who's willing to call him on his shit and is looking out for his best interests.
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is actually a really good interesting scene between them because, like, I think I was mentioning last episode when we were talking about The Field Where I Die that we rarely see scenes where Mulder and Scully kind of yell at each other.
Yeah.
And I don't ever count this because clearly Mulder's under the influence. Like he wouldn't normally be yelling at her during a conversation like this. Like,
yeah, no.
But she is trying to communicate with him, sort of responding in kind. Like she's being very serious with him right now. Like I care about my job. I mean, and she's told him already she wouldn't put herself on the line for anyone but him. But like at the same time, she wants to be sure she's putting herself on the line for something, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's very reasonable. She's
it's
a little bit of there's a little contentiousness between them, but it is like very reasonable on her side. She's not saying I'm scared of losing my job. It's just if I'm going to lose my job, please tell me this is worth it.
Exactly.
And that's it's a very reasonable suggestion. And even in his befuddled state, he responds pretty well to that in the end and said, I'll get all right. You want answers. I will get answers for you. And puts the X on the window. obviously trying to get some answers for her. So I think that's very fair. He respects her desire to find that out.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I keep getting sort of mixed up because we've been jumping all over the episodes, but like I'm trying to remember, like, when did he meet X? Was that in One Breath or was it before? Was that all the way back in Little Green Men? I'm trying to remember when we first met X.
I want to say, was it Little Green Men?
It might have been. I can't remember now.
But yeah, I'm blanking on it too. But it was sometime early in, we'll say early season two.
Yeah. I'm wondering
somewhere in there.
When, I mean, we clearly they've had a conversation at some point about X because Scully doesn't say, why are you putting that on the window, Mulder?
How is that going to help?
What is this going to do? You know, like, she gets it. And I enjoy that you don't necessarily need to see that scene to know that at some point
And she's actually, she had that sort of confrontation with him, didn't she, in Endgame, where she sort of called him up. Called him to Mulder's apartment.
Yes, you're right.
And to find out information about Mulder, and he shows up. And they have a very brief encounter. So, yeah, Scully knows what Mr. X is about at this point.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry, sometimes I have to, like, line everything up in my mind. And that's also when, like, Skinner beats him up in the elevator, or they beat each other
up, too.
Yeah, that was hot. Okay. It's all coming back to me now.
But this is the trouble when we're just constantly rewatching episodes, right? It's hard to remember sometimes what happens in what order. But he's been around a bit at this point. We know Mr. X pretty well, even though he doesn't actually show up in this episode. But we know what the X means. We as the audience know, and Scully knows.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so Scully goes and does Mulder's bidding, as she does, and figures out what this... or attempts to figure out what this code is. And
she starts doing her research.
Yeah, she does. She's quite the busy bee in this episode.
She's got the connection. She's talking to the right woman who knows the right people. She's making it happen.
And she does. I do think that she does get real lucky in terms of getting hooked up with Albert Hosteen.
Yeah, that is a really wonderful coincidence. Every Navajo speaker knows each other, which I'm pretty sure they don't. But it's a very nice coincidence in this case.
But, I mean, I suppose Albert Hosteen has obviously been a code encryptor for World War II. Like, he's in their database or whatever. So, like, it makes sense that, like, she would know him as one of these few people that do this. But part of me wonders also if Albert Hosteen is sort of making this happen. Like, could he have been calling around him and, like, if somebody comes to you, give me a call? Because I feel like somebody... I could imagine him calling this woman up and saying, there will be a woman with... bright red hair. She will come to you. Please have her call me. Like, I could feel like he could say something like that.
It does seem like, it doesn't seem like a weird coincidence at the time. It just kind of seems like Albert's just there on the periphery all the time. Whenever Mulder and Scully are doing stuff, he just somehow knows.
He knows shit.
And so it just feels like, you know, of course, this is all happening because it's meant to happen.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So Scully goes back to his apartment. Is this where she finds the bullet? I don't remember if that's later.
Yeah.
She does get the bullet.
No, that's where she gets shot at.
And she gets shot at and I mean, nicked. It hits her.
She gets shot.
Yeah.
I mean, let's put it on the table. A lot of people are getting shot in this episode, but Scully's one of them. It gets kind of glossed over.
Yeah.
Any other episode, Scully being grazed by a bullet would be like the major event of the episode, probably.
People forget.
This one, it's like boom, boom, boom. We have to kind of forget about it a couple of scenes later. But she's clearly very rattled by it, as you would be, it nearly having almost, you know, being shot in the head.
It makes me think of Mulder getting nearly shot in the head in Fight the Future. It's like very similar scenario. Like, they both sort of get, Mulder probably a little more so, but slightly grazed in the head. And then they're just like up and running. And why does she... stay in the apartment where she just got nearly shot? Like, why is she just hanging around in there?
Is she still in his apartment when she's on the phone to him later on?
I
think she is, right? Because I was trying to look at that and think, it doesn't look like her apartment. I think she's still in his apartment, which you wouldn't think she would be. You'd like anywhere but there, maybe. I guess she figures, well, they've taken their shot and I guess they're not coming back. I don't know.
Or she's kind of like, I'm afraid to go out into the parking lot because clearly there's someone here who's trying to kill me. Like, I can.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a good idea. She's clearly very rattled when she answers that phone.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, Jillian being awesome as always, just the way she says hello when she answers the phone is a little bit heartbreaking. She's clearly nervous and tense. But of course, you know, there's other things to discuss as well.
Well, we didn't bring up the fact that Mulder in this meanwhile has been called by Bill, and you can tell he's shocked to be getting this call. And
they don't have that kind of relationship.
No, but he's like, he's essentially like, you know, come up. It's very important. You got to come. And like Mulder hops to it. And I feel like, to Mulder's credit, as shitty as he has been treated by his parents, and I don't want to round it down to that because it's a lot more complicated. But like, anytime they need him, he is there. Like he's hopping there. Like, what do they need? And I do dig that about Mulder. It's like he's
a good son.
He is. He's a good son, and or at least he tries really hard to be. And I enjoy that.
Yeah, yeah.
Bill, I have to point out that he hugs him this time.
Yes, which Mulder seems quite surprised by.
Yeah, and I think this kind of adds a little bit of the evidence that I think he knows he's gonna die. Like, I think he knows he is not long for this world because of what he's about to do.
You can kind of see it in Bill's eyes that he's very sort of like feeling very emotional. And yeah, this is not an ordinary encounter. There's something big going on, and that something big is that he's probably going to wind up dead for this. So he's just, he's acting more emotional than he normally would.
Right. And I mean, I noticed too later that when he's in the middle of his speech, like right before he gets to the good stuff that he never gets to say.
Of course. Yeah.
He does go to the restroom and he's taking some pills. And so it makes me wonder if he's killing himself. It never occurred to me before.
Oh, that didn't occur to me. No.
But I was wondering.
We never really find out, I suppose.
Yeah. We don't know what pills he's taking or why, but we do find him with pills. And so it made me wonder if he was like, I'm going to tell Mulder. He's going to hate me. I'm going to want to die. Like, I wonder if it's that dark. Like, I
it could be.
It just made me wonder. I don't know if that's the case, but you do show him. They also show him. They make a point of showing him locking the door. Like, it's kind of strange. It's like, okay, yeah, lock the door. Mm-hmm. But is that important to the story? Why are we showing it? You know, and that's like, it was just an interesting shot to me. Like,
interesting. What? Yeah, I had never thought of that, but I think that that's certainly a possibility.
Yeah, I don't even know if I subscribe to that, but I just thought it was interesting to bring up
it's
as a possibility.
Theory, though. Yeah, absolutely.
So some of the things that Bill says, you tell he's trying to tell Mulder the truth. He doesn't quite get there, but he is kind of, in my opinion, he is sort of expressing his love to his son the only way he knows how. Like, he's saying that he respects him. You're smarter than me. You know, your politics are yours. You've never thrown in. You know, and he, like, you know, like I said, he was the lone dissenter until he couldn't be. And then he had to leave, and he probably has forever felt guilty about that, you know. Yeah. So, and I like the line he says that you're going to learn of things and they'll come to make sense to you. This kind of plays into what he says in the blessing way, but it also plays into all the way through the series. Like, I mean, it made me think of his line again. I'm going to bring up the truth, the series finale, when Mulder finally does learn of the colonization date and says that, you know, the truth came to him like the speed of light. You know, like it's you learn something and you can't unlearn it. And I find that kind of a fascinating concept, like when he's been looking his whole life for this truth and when he finds out, it's like the last thing he wants to know. Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure Bill can relate to that. So
absolutely.
And he calls Samantha the merchandise, which was also mentioned earlier as one of the, or he doesn't say Samantha. Sorry. We know now that he means Samantha, but he says the merchandise, which is one of the words that Scully had figured out was on the.
Yes. Navajo. We already know at that point that, that the sort of encoded documents include that word. So we already know that's an important word.
But we still don't quite know what that means, I think. Like, we know, we know now, we can think about what it means now. But at the time, were you sort of like figuring all this out, or was this all just kind of like too much information for you to process? Were you?
I think I was keeping up at that point. I mean, we kind of get a little bit more information about this merchandise concept sort of at the end of the episode. So yeah, it's all just very, but it's one of those things. It's all very intriguing that, you know, you don't quite understand what he's talking about, but it's clearly interesting. And so that's good enough. You don't have to understand it. Mm-hmm. You just have to know that it sounds intriguing, and it definitely did.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that it does appear like he's about to say to Mulder, the truth about Samantha. I mean, he says, like, I've made these horrible choices, blah, blah, blah. And then he can't take it. And he has to get up and leave and go to the bathroom and, like, look at himself in the mirror. And this is all so powerful, especially with all we know now. Like, it's just, it's very layered. And
it really is.
So he gets shot by Krychek, of course.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Poor Mulder, and the terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day gets worse.
It really does.
Yeah, so he goes, and this is actually a really powerful scene, and it's not that I forgot about it, but every time I watch it, I forget how powerful it is, when he's saying to Mulder, forgive me. And Mulder is, like, very grief-stricken, obviously. Like, this is, he didn't have a great relationship with his father, obviously, but it's still his father, and he's just been shot, and just like his mother later, his parent dies just before he was about to be told the truth.
Honestly, it's just terrible.
Yeah. And I mean, it just, it's so sad to me that, like, poor Mulder, all he wants is the truth and they can't get it. Can't get it.
Yeah. Always just so close, but so far away.
Yeah. I wrote here because I thought it was important that he moved the body. Which
I know that always drives me crazy. Like, that's one of those things that drives me crazy. It's like, you are an FBI agent and you think that he's smart enough to say to Scully, I can't leave the crime scene. So he's clearly thinking in those terms. But you think it's a good idea to take the body and for some reason lay him on the couch? Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, I just think at this point he's just very much out of his head. Like, he's gone loco. Like, he's got he's already got all this LSD or whatever in his system. His dad has just been shot. He's not thinking clearly, obviously.
Yes, I need to cut him a bit of a break, probably.
Yeah, but it is strange. I mean, I think that moving him to the couch kind of makes me think, like, he's like, oh, he's just trying to make him comfortable or whatever. Like, it's very sad. But at the same time,
it's very sad. It's an understandable thing that you would do. Like, obviously, as an FBI agent, he should know better. But it's his dad. And so, you know, at the end of the day, he's going to be driven by emotion. And so that is kind of an understandable human emotional response.
Right. So this is where he calls her and she's at his apartment. But, like, Scully's clearly, like you said, yet again, she's the one sort of thinking clearly this entire episode.
Yes, as usual, she is sorting him out.
Mm-hmm. And I think for a split second, she does consider that he might have done it. Like, I think that...
she does. I mean, she right away asks him, were you arguing? It's the first thing practically that she says when Mulder tells her that his father has been shot.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much the first thing she says. And it's not an unreasonable question.
No, I mean, and like she says, like, he's been behaving erratically. Like, you, and I love the idea and violent. Yep. And she's trying to sort of explain this to him rationally when he cannot really be rationalized with at this moment. Yeah. And I think she sort of starts to get that and then is essentially just giving him very simple instructions. Like, you just need to go. Like, them finding you there is going to only make everything worse, especially like with you and your condition. I mean, even though, like, there really is no good answer here, I kind of tend to agree with her that she just wants him to be okay. At the end of the day, I need to see you. I need to make sure you're fine.
Well, and she knows for a fact that people are out to get him and to shoot him. So,
and she wants to prove to herself that he didn't do it, I think, at the same time. I mean, I think she's motivated by that. Like, you get here, I can get your gun, I can take it to ballistics, I can clear your name. I mean, that's her first priority right now.
She's looking out for him in another way at this point, you know. Now he needs her help in a different way. He's not asking for it, but he needs it, and she's sorting it out. She's thinking clearly. She's like, okay, get yourself out of there. Nope, not to your apartment, to my apartment. So she's getting it all clearly laid out. She's going to take care of this.
Yep. And I have here, just in all caps, Huggies scene.
Huggy scene. I had this as one of my top 10 hottest moments.
Well, coming up,
when he shows up at her apartment, it's everything is hotness from there on out for me.
It really is. I mean, I just love the idea that, like, they obviously just can't stop touching each other for no reason. But
they cannot.
Yeah, he falls on her and he's just hugging, and it's like poor Mulder. He's just having the worst day. But I love it when she cares for him. Like, her first instinct is always, priority one, make sure he's okay. Come here, lay down in my bed. It's okay. Don't worry about it. Just lay down in my bed. That's fine.
And she's
we
just
don't mind either.
Carry him.
Exactly. And it's a really great scene. You can tell she's super concerned about him. He's just very much out of it, you know. And I did.
He'll just do whatever she tells him to do at that point. You know, he's out of it. And obviously, you know, he's gone a little crazy, but still, obviously, some part of him knows that, at least at that moment, that he can trust her because he's just going to do whatever she says.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and she really must have stayed up with him all night, like, especially if he had really bad fever and he had all this other stuff, like, obviously waiting for the stuff to get out of his system. And I did write here, which I thought was really, I didn't even mean this to be very profound, but I wrote, her first instinct is to save him with the truth.
That's so beautiful.
Because that's what it is. It's like she leaves him, you know, half naked in her bed. Of course, we have.
Yeah, more than mentioning. Half. I'm
more than
90%.
Half. Yeah. Mostly naked in her bed and takes his gun. But what he doesn't understand is, like, she is doing this because she trusts and believes in him so implicitly that she is, her first instinct is to be like, I'm going to go clear your name. That's the first thing. Like,
if she still suspected he was guilty at that point, she wouldn't be taking his gun to the FBI lab and comparing it with the shots from the crime scene. So,
yeah,
she's just there to clear his name.
Yeah. And we do here have sort of the epitome of his kind of, I don't want to say insanity, that's not the right word, but his affected demeanor, where he is now yelling at Scully and he's like, you've been watching me with your little notes.
Taking your little notes. That's when we know for sure he's, like, really gone completely wonky at that point. That's his craziest that he is in the whole episode, really.
It is. It's
I,
like,
mean, I guess
peak.
Punching the Skinner was pretty bad, but somehow this seems more shocking.
It is, because it's Scully. And I mean, and even she can see it too. Like, she's like, you're not yourself. Like, I don't know if she says that exactly, but she's essentially saying, like, you know, I'm trying to help you. Like, you are being crazy. Like, just slow down.
But, you know, but again, she doesn't let it put her off. She doesn't get mad at him, even though he's being, you know, quite sort of a little harsh to her. Mm-hmm. She still, you know, keeps calm. She knows what's going on. Something is wrong with Mulder. I'm not going to take any of this personally. I'm just going to very calmly and coolly go about clearing his name and sorting his whole life out for him.
Exactly. And she probably just hopes and prays that he's going to stay put in her bedroom, but he won't. But anyway, she actually, I think this might be where she goes back to get the bullet. I don't know if she already did or if I don't remember.
That must be when she goes back to get the bullet that was shot at her.
That makes sense, because that's the reason that she's back at his apartment, to see the water being contaminated. Like, she's that's right, she's getting the bullet. She sees the water and she discovers that the water's been contaminated.
She figures it out again. She figures it out because Scully is so great.
Yep.
And I mean, she just sees that truck sort of delivering the water softener equipment or whatever the heck that stuff is. And immediately she's sort of like, what's all this then? Mm-hmm. And, you know, smart, following her instincts, going down, checking out, seeing right away what's going on.
Yep.
Loving it.
Worth mentioning again that Duchovny, you know, wrote this story. He wanted Scully to shine, and I enjoy
that. Right. Absolutely. And she does.
And she absolutely does. God, and she even gets to shoot him. I wonder if Duchovny was, like, working out some stuff with this episode. Anyway, so Mulder ends up taking a cab home from Scully's. Like, I don't know how he got to her place, but I'm assuming maybe he took a cab, because he pulls up in a car, right, to Martha's vineyard.
Yeah, he obviously drove to the vineyard. Maybe he drove back to her place, but for some reason didn't take his car back to his apartment, or he took a
cab
taxi from all the way from Martha's the vineyard, which would seem very expensive. I don't know.
Yeah, that's crazy. I don't know.
But he left his car behind at some point.
Their car situation always confuses me, because I'm always just like, they have a car when it's convenient, and then they take cabs whenever it's not convenient to have a car. And I guess that's what you do in DC. Yeah. I don't know. But I do think that, like, this whole scene where he gets home and he sees, you know, Krycek lurking around in the alleyway. Mm-hmm. This whole scene where he's just kicking Krycek's ass is super hot. I had to write that.
Yeah, that's just, like, I wrote down, it's a good old-fashioned Krycek beatdown, because we get several of those, and this is a solid one.
Yeah, anytime Mulder gets to just kick the shit out of Krycek, it is hot.
Yeah,
it kind of is. Yeah, it's hot. It's I enjoy it.
I very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, so this is one of those moments, too, that, like, Scully is she down in the basement looking at the water and then coming up and then witnessing this? Because she's already there, I feel like.
Yeah. I mean, she's somewhere in the building.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really trouble me exactly where she was. She either, like, heard something outside when she was in his apartment, or like, yeah, coming up from the basement, something like that.
Yeah, but like, yeah.
But she's there. We know she's in the build. We already know she's in the building, so it doesn't seem odd that she suddenly appears.
Right, exactly. So she is, again, trying to sort of like rationalize with Mulder, who cannot be rationalized with at the moment.
Yeah.
Or cannot be reasoned with, I guess I should be saying. And he is about to shoot Krycek. Like, and love that.
And they explicitly show that with like his finger on the trigger, you know, close up of that. So it's very clear to the audience that Scully absolutely had to shoot him.
Right. It is. And I, again, very nicely staged, directed. Everything is planted perfectly. Yeah. And I like, again, that Scully she's doing what she has to do. And she's just being really smart. You know, she knows. Yeah. She knows this is what has to happen, even though it's sort of shocking to see. And we can be very thankful that her markswomanship is very good.
That bears out throughout the whole series.
Yeah.
She's always an awesome shot. And I love that about her. And she definitely uses it here to her advantage. I remember how shocking it was at the time. Like, holy shit, Scully just shot Mulder. Oh, my God. We were very distressed.
Did you, at the time, did you kind of get it right away why she was doing that? Or did you think that, is Scully a bad guy? Because I feel like they are sort of trying to mess with our expectations a little bit here.
Yeah, I mean, I never thought she was a bad guy, but I just thought it was a little bit of an overreaction. Why are you so desperate to save Krycek? It just seems like that's a little much. Like, what are you doing that for? It didn't seem like, I didn't imagine that she was on Krycek's side, but I thought it was a bit of a strange choice to make and not very nice to Mulder to shoot him just to save Krycek.
Right.
Come on.
Right.
But then, of course, we find out later on it's actually to save Mulder and everything is fine.
Exactly. It's like once she gets to explain it, then it all makes sense. And it makes sense to him, too. I love the scene. I like the idea that like she essentially drove with Mulder for like 48 hours and he's been in he's essentially been unconscious and she missed her meeting and she just everything, all of it just to protect him. Literally, she was worried he was going to get killed or, you know, sent
to jail. She wants to look out for him and also to get to the truth because she wants to go see Albert Hosteen. And so she's continuing the investigation and she's looking after Mulder at the same time.
Yep.
It's just Scully making it all happen.
And great multitasking, like you just said. Like
really great.
She's like, well, I got to go to Albert Hosteen anyway. So I might as well just bring Mulder with me.
I'm going to just shove him in the back seat or something.
Strap him into a car seat, give him a box of juice, and we'll be good. We're going to go on a road trip.
Pretty much. Yeah. It's a smart idea.
Yeah. So this scene, I just love the idea that like Albert Hosteen is there and he's just like working on his little papers and she's taking care of Mulder and they just have their own little like hotel party going on.
They're all like, you know, fitting well together. They all get along well. Albert just fits right in with Mulder and Scully right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Just like such good friends to them. So I love it.
And she cannot stop staring at his chest, which not Albert's, but Mulder's. Which I cannot blame her for, I must say.
Yeah, no one can. I mean, I was probably staring at it too, so I probably didn't even notice that.
Yeah, and I mean, I wanted to point this out because I just thought this was super interesting, and this is me getting a little too speculative and symbolic, but I like the idea that Mulder says, like, or she's like, he's like, why this happened to you, or you know why this happened to you, or whatever, and he says, because I was getting too close to the truth. And then, this happens so often to them, right? This is happening to them over and over. They get too close to the truth and then they essentially get like shoved back to square one. It makes me think so much of just the progression of their relationship as well, because I feel see that same thing over and over. Like they get real close. They're almost going to talk about something, like some huge thing happens. And then suddenly we're thrust into the next episode and we're back at the beginning again. And no one's going to talk about it and nothing has happened. And it's just kind of cool that like these two parallel storylines are going on. It's like you're getting too close to the truth. Oh, reel it back over here with their relationship. You're getting too close to the truth about your relationship. Better reel it back.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, very much in parallel.
It's just interesting to me. I love it.
I'm always a bit confused, though, about this concept, this explanation of why Mulder was drugged, because he's getting too close to the truth. But at the point when he was starting to be drugged, he didn't actually have the documents yet. He hadn't received the tape from the Thinker yet, because that's why the lone gunmen show up. So are we to think that the syndicate just assumed Mulder would get these documents. They knew at that point that they'd been hacked. Mm-hmm. Someone has them. Mulder will probably wind up with them. So let's get him all poisoned so that he acts wackadoodle and no one believes him. Or that the way Scully puts it was that, you know, that you wouldn't have anyone to trust or no one will be able to trust you. And it seems like a very complex way to deal with a fairly simple situation, which is that they thought Mulder would get the tape, and then they're trying to just, I guess, discredit him.
Yeah.
It all seems very elaborate.
It is rather elaborate. But I think for the most part, they are constantly with their plans. They're not necessarily trying to just kill him, because if they wanted to just kill him, they would have done that. I think that Mulder helps them, like, in a weird way. I think when Mulder kind of screams his theories, it just makes them seem more crazy and less probable. And so keeping him around is helpful for them.
That is true. And you're right that Mulder kind of, you know, plays right into that kind of game.
Exactly.
If they're trying to, like, they're just taking what's already a weakness, which is his general crazy vibe, and then just, you know, let's just amp that up by, you know, 10 degrees. That it kind of makes some sense in a way. I mean, perhaps it was just like a happy coincidence that it also kind of put him in a position where he could be blamed for his dad's death. I can't imagine that they planned that necessarily in advance, but that sure worked out well for them that it also would have put him into the role of suspect in that death as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like that's the situation. It would have just taken care of itself. I mean, suddenly, it doesn't necessarily get rid of him. But it helps them to have him be doing all of this stuff. To your earlier point, the timing of it is a little dicey. But they did say, I feel like the gunman did say that Mulder's name was attached somewhere connection with the thinker that he was trying to get in touch with him. Yeah.
Yes. So, that's right. And they may well, you're right. They may well have intercepted that.
So assuming they intercepted that, you could assume that they had put the plan into effect immediately. So I don't necessarily know if I buy that Mulder was already suffering the effects that very first night when they arrived. But again, I think it's for the sake of storytelling. I'll forgive it because I feel like they're just sort of trying to plant these things so that we can follow the story.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to pack in and they don't have a whole lot of time to plant this stuff. So every scene's got to serve like several purposes. So I can definitely live with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I do love Mulder's moment here of like he's finally back to normal, right? We have like our normal Mulder
finally,
back.
Yeah, the whole episode, we finally get one scene with normal Mulder.
Yeah, and he says it's just so sweet how he says thank you for taking care of me. Like my heart just goes pitter pat when he like takes the time out to sort of check in emotionally. It's very important, and you can tell Scully's touched by it too because she's given up a lot to be here, you know, and he's mindful of that.
And he appreciates it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wrote in my notes, he has a lot to thank her for. But yeah, he at least, you know, does take that moment to thank her. And it's, you can tell how sincere he is in that gratitude. It's you know, it definitely comes from the heart. And I remember how much we as shippers swooned over that. Like, we just ate that shit up. That was great. I mean, that scene between them, it's super hot, actually. Like, that moment when Scully looks at him and says, I was certain they would have killed you, Mulder. It's just like the eye fucking going on in that scene is like off the hook for me. So like finally Mulder shows up and it's like instantly we get some magical MSR going on. So I love that.
It's funny though. Yeah, we get real Mulder back and then the MSR cranks back up. It's true. And then there's like a moment where he gets up and like he kind of touches her knee. Like, even like just dumb little things like that, of course, we notice.
Love it. So, it's pretty great. I love that scene.
And I do love the moment, too, where she does get to sort of say, hey, you know, there's another reason here. My name is in these files. Like, obviously, Albert Hostein has been, decrypting. Why can't I think of what the right word is? Is he
encrypt? You encrypt.
Encrypt. And then you decrypt?
I can't remember. What's the term for that?
We're going to get letters. But anyway, he's decoding, I guess.
Disencrypt.
That thing that he's doing. Anyway, we find out that Scully's name is somehow in there, which is obviously going to definitely come back into play in the latter part of this trilogy, which we will come back
to. I love that. I mean, like, as if enough hasn't happened already in this episode, boom, we get a callback to Scully's abduction, and suddenly that's coming to the fore again, and I'm like, oh yeah, this just took a real interesting twist.
Anytime I know the abduction comes up, you get super excited.
I get it. That is my kink. I just love that. So I was pretty excited. I remember at the time being super excited because it came kind of out of nowhere. Like there's no, it doesn't really seem to, nothing seems to lead up to it. It's just like, oh my God, twist. Yeah.
So, I mean, can you imagine how alarming that would be to be like, oh, this really, really old document that they have uncovered since, I don't know, what, the 40s? It goes all the way back to the 40s, and yet your name is in it? Like,
yeah, to feel that you are somehow part of this huge conspiracy is just like, you can tell that it has shaken her and that she is looking to Mulder to make sense of that for her.
Yeah.
And that's what Mulder, I mean, Mulder is many things to her, but in this case, she's counting on him to figure this out. Right. And that's, you know, she's done so much for him in this episode. And now she knows that he can do that for her. And I love that.
Right. And I mean, he doesn't get to do a whole lot in the rest of this and the next episode, but he does get to do some in Paperclip, which we will get back to.
He does.
He tries. He tries his best. But yeah, I think Albert is, again, I think this is another kind of clue that he knows what's going on. You know, he takes Mulder and he says that there are lies buried in the desert, right? Which is, it just, to me, it's very cryptic, but it indicates to me that he knows more than he's letting on, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, he's just, I like how he speaks. He's very, he's
like, it's beautifully written.
Yeah, it really is.
And beautifully delivered.
Very well done. So Mulder is out in the desert with Eric. They're, you know, just kind of poking around, riding on motorbikes.
Mulder's wearing his wonderful blue shirt that he basically wears for the rest of this sort of three-parter. Yeah. And if you're going to be stuck in one shirt, that's an excellent one to be stuck in.
And jeans.
Yeah. Great look.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah.
Smokey Man calls him. He's got Mulder on speed dial. When's the last time they talked? To each other. I'm trying to remember.
I know, I'm trying to think. It doesn't seem like a very common thing.
Is it in Little Green Men when, like, they're in the office and Skinner kicks him out? Like,
It must be, yeah. But they don't really talk to each other very much, do they? But I guess they have a little bit of interaction.
He knows
that's
enough.
That's the closest thing.
To immediately know who he is.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's so funny, like, we have such a huge gap between doing these episodes that I feel like I could be just forgetting something, but I just think it's funny how he happens to be right where they need him to be when Smoking Man calls him. Which is just, again, is this just like a super lucky thing, or does, like you said, is this whole thing orchestrated? Like, they know exactly where Mulder's going, they know where he's going to be, they have pinpointed his cell location to be New Mexico, and so they know that he's going to find the boxcar. And then they're able to, and this is all a really great sequence where it's like he hangs up from him, and I do like the idea that he says it's like his last ditch effort to get Mulder to stop by saying, well, if you expose this, you're only going to expose your father. It's like he's trying, which, well, I suppose it's slightly true. He is trying to get Mulder to stop, and he thinks that that's sort of the way to do that.
Yeah.
Which I think is clever of him, but Mulder is not having it. He's like, no, fuck you, dude. Hangs up the phone, but the sequence is really cool. Like, they get the track on his location, and Smokey Man's right there next to his handy helicopter, and he runs over and he gets on. He's like, let's go. And
things are happening.
Yeah, I just love it. I think that anytime Smokey Man gets on or off a helicopter is a really great scene, must say.
It always is. He does a great helicopter passenger look. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. So Mulder and Eric find the boxcar again, and Eric's very helpful. He, you know, takes him down there and shows him the opening.
Yeah.
And they get on, or Mulder goes in, and Eric, I guess, is standing watch. I don't know why he doesn't go in with him, but other than to, you know, create all of the circumstances that we are about to see. But I don't know how important this is, but it's worth mentioning. This is Sierra Pacific Railroad, I didn't look that up. I should have, to see if it was a real railroad, if it actually had a line that went through that area that maybe was abandoned, which is all possible, which would explain why the boxcar is there, which I probably should have looked into. Maybe I'll look into that later. But I do like the idea that even though we're about to lose Mulder, quote unquote, this final scene is them talking on the phone to each other. And he's got really good reception in that boxcar.
That's all I can ever think. You're underground in a boxcar and you've got crystal clear reception.
They should have had like some product placement here, you know,
they really
considering
should
all the product placement they did for Ford or whatever in the revival.
Yeah, really?
You know, it's not, Sierra Pacific.
Would have been perfect time.
Sierra Pacific. What about Pacific Bell at that point? It should have been. Was that even around? Wow, I dated myself with that one. But yeah, I always think it's so funny how crystal clear they can talk to him on his shitty, like, 1994, 95 honestly cell phone.
But they have to have this awesome conversation.
They do. It's a great conversation because she, you know, she's obviously looking for answers. So I feel like in this moment, she's going to give him the benefit of the doubt. But like, he's obviously saying he's reporting to her everything he's seeing. Obviously, it's all this crazy shit that Scully should be seeing. But we still don't quite know what we're seeing. It certainly looks alien, but this later is sort of turned on its head again, I want to say, in, is it like Nisei in 731 or one of those, like one of those later season three episodes where we find out that, like, you know, a lot of these were just people that were experimented on that had gone bad, you know? But these are clearly, these are like, what do you think these are? Do you think these are aliens or do you think these are just like test subjects or because they show them walking around and squealing and like.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, certainly in the context of this episode and sort of where it is, I definitely assumed that they were aliens and that they had been experimented on as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were, for whatever reason, yet to be explained, experimenting on aliens. So that was clear to me, especially because Scully seems like totally on board with the idea of it being alien. She doesn't even really question it. All she asks Mulder is, are you sure? Because he says, you know, from the look of it, I'd say they were alien. And all Scully says is, are you sure? Like, to me, that says to her, that says that she believes that it could well be aliens. And it's like, well, if Scully seems to think they're aliens, they probably are.
The only thing that like confuses me about this, and this is one of the things about the X-Files mythology that I'm forever sort of stumped and stymied by, is this entire idea of the vaccination scar and the smallpox scar. Because why are the aliens being injected with smallpox vaccine? That to me says that these are humans that are being injected with something. Yeah. Or that have been injected with something. This is actually a good question for you because the smallpox vaccine was well beyond my day. And I don't know if this is something that maybe you're aware of or like your parents are aware
of. I have a smallpox vaccination scar.
Do you have an actual scar?
Yeah. Where is it?
Like, why is there a scar? Is this because vaccinations
were... You can barely see it now, but yeah, no, it looks exactly like, you know, you can barely see it on the alien, but it looks exactly like that. It's like a little very tiny sort of dime size, like little pucker of skin sort of.
See, well, like a dime size is not small to me. That's like fucking enormous. And I mean, this is me. When all of my vaccinations, I don't have scars from them. It's a niggle that goes away. So this is all interesting information to me.
Yeah,
what is so different about this vaccination?
Yeah, I don't recall getting the smallpox vaccination, but I do have the scar. So I must have, I know that I got it. I mean, you know, all of my siblings did too. So I must have been very young when I got it because I don't recall it. So I think they must have, I don't know. It was clearly not a regular needle. It must have been some kind of like, I don't know. I'm picturing something kind of like the sort of size and shape as like a car cigarette lighter kind of thing coming at you. I've never questioned it. It's like, this is my vaccination scar. Shoulder shrug. I've never even thought about it. It's totally normal for me sort of growing up. Everyone had them.
Right. I mean, and that's what I find fascinating and I don't know about because like I said, I don't have a vaccination scar. I've had plenty of vaccinations in my day, but none have been like that. So I wonder
there's something unique clearly about that. I think I'm not even totally sure if it's just the smallpox vaccination that comes with that one or if it's smallpox plus something else. I've never questioned it, to be honest, which shows you how very trusting we were of the government back then.
But
it's never struck me as sort of odd in any way. But now that I think about it, it probably sounds super odd to people who are younger than I am. So I'll have to do some research into that now, I think, and see exactly what it consisted of and when they stopped doing it. But
yeah
I definitely have the scar. I think Sandy, my husband, who is from Scotland, has one too. So obviously this was a fairly sort of international thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm aware that everybody got them. I'm just, what I'm not aware of is that why they leave a dime-shaped scar. And like,
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's convenient for X-Files lore because they can see the evidence of this having been done, which I find fascinating. But like, again, that is a clue to me that these aren't aliens, that these are humans.
Right. Yeah. And we get more into kind of this idea of what they're doing with the smallpox vaccine. It's kind of like a, if I'm remembering correctly, like a they're taking a tissue sample at the same time or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's just a vague sense that it involves some kind of mysterious experimentation.
Or, they're cataloging people, so to speak.
It doesn't really. They were doing it to aliens. Why would you be doing to aliens the exact same thing you're doing to humans? Who knows?
Well, plus, I think that the fear is that you're getting this. I mean, and I know people, there has been some controversy about the idea of this sort of being an argument for the anti-vaxxers, which was clearly not the argument at the time when they were writing this. I mean, they're just kind of trying to write a cool sci-fi television show. You know what I mean? Do you know what's being put into your body? But I feel like they do that a lot on these episodes, like on throughout the series. And I feel like the idea that you could be experimented on and not even be aware of it, I think is just another thing the X-Files does really well in terms of creating this fear in you and this distrust of the government, which is, I think, pretty much what all they're trying to accomplish with the smallpox vaccination stuff. But it is a really interesting and clever way, too, to come up with something that affected a vast majority of the population.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's too late now, you know?
Exactly. And so people like me, my age, watching that at the time in the 90s, we are all sitting there with our vaccination scars saying, oh, my God, what's happening? So, it was very cool. And it would have had, it would have... would have read very differently at the time. If you did something like that today, it would read very differently. It would just feel very much like you're sort of just sliding into the anti-vaxxer movement.
Yeah.
And whereas that wasn't a thing back then.
Right.
So no one would have reacted to think that that was kind of weird. It would have just seemed like a chilling suggestion of the idea, because that is something that literally everyone got. And so the idea of it being something sinister was just super chilling. So that's the sort of, that's the message. Because, they took something very ordinary, something that everyone has, and made it suddenly very scary.
Which is, what they do best.
They do.
And I mean, this is a very, very great cliffhanger. We have...
Oh, my God. Honestly.
We have Smoking Man coming down, raiding the area. Poor Eric. He's just like, I was just showing him the aliens.
It's awesome though, because like CSM is asking him all these questions.
He will
and
not
Eric
give
is
in.
Not
nope.
Answering his questions. I love the attitude that Eric's giving in this scene.
Eric is a badass and a hero, and I enjoy him. He did not give it. He didn't give up. Didn't give up. Anything.
Given a word.
Mm-hmm. And I love that. I mean, and they clearly tried to get it out of him, as we
they
see
did.
In the
and
next
he was
episode.
Like, nope. He's just like defiant. Yeah. I love that about.
I do. And I think they kind of established that really early in the episode, which I enjoyed. Like, he's just kind of has this sort of teenage attitude. Like, I think when Albert said the thing to him about the snakes being angry, he was like, okay, old man, whatever you say. All right. he's got this, but at the same time, you can tell he's a very caring person, which I enjoy.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah. And so Smoky Man, burn it. You know, what are you going to do? Seriously.
Burn
and
us.
That's what a great parallel to burn it. When he in Fight the Future again, when he says to burn the alien, burn it like the others, it's all burn it all. That's the best way to get rid of this evidence, is just to burn it. And I mean, we'll talk about this next episode, but I'm assuming that Mulder has found some sort of exit inside the boxcar, like another opening or a door, and he has somehow escaped already at this point before the thing has been torched, and is somehow out, like, he's underground under the rocks, but he's out of the boxcar to have survived this.
That's my understanding. I'm going to have to rewatch Blessing Way to sort of see exactly what degree of explanation we get.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I imagine it in my head, at least.
Right.
Although, but at the time, of course, we had no clue what was happening. We right. were like, oh, my God, no. And this was the season finale. And all we knew was that Mulder was in that boxcar. Like, how could you possibly get out? And it does not look good for him. I mean, we knew, obviously, Mulder wasn't going to die, but it sure was going to be a tense wait to find out how he's going to get out.
Yeah. And I mean, they mess with us a lot that way. I mean, there's a lot of cliffhangers totally. Where you think one of them or the other is dead. And that's yeah, just, it's honestly. Mean and rude and it's good television.
It really so. Is. This one, this one really stands out in my head when I think about cliffhangers that made the summer feel really long. This is the one that really stands out. Maybe because it was quite an early one.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't quite so jaded by the time we got into later seasons. It's like, yeah, whatever. You'll just come up with some whatever explanation.
Yeah.
But at the time it was like super shocking. Like season one ended with Deep Throat being shot, which was pretty shocking. And now, oh my God, Mulder. So that was shocking too. So we weren't quite so jaded about, you know, this is going to happen every season now.
Yeah.
It was still pretty new. And so, yeah, I remember that being like, oh man, we cannot wait to see what's going to happen next.
Also, really quick question before we wrap this up. Did we see the end of the conversation with Mulder and Scully? Like, does he hang up on her or do they hang up?
I think he gets cut off essentially because I understand the lid closes, which I believe Eric does because mm-hmm. the helicopter shows up. So I think Eric is doing that to sort of hide what they've been up to, basically, perhaps in the hopes that the helicopter will just keep on flying. So that's essentially, I think, where they basically get cut off. I don't know if they actually literally show either. Well, we never see either of them again after that in that scene. But I think our understanding is that they're cut off because the lid gets shut. Maybe he finally loses that great reception at that moment.
I would think so. I mean, and clearly, like, he's not telling Scully, I'm in a boxcar. Come yeah. find me. Because, yeah. like, I mean, I'm trying to remember, like, she has to ask Albert where he is, so
yeah.
But yeah, great cliffhanger.
Yeah, so I think that's it. Ends on Mulder saying, oh my God, Scully, what have they done? And boom, that's they're sort of cut off at that on that note.
Exactly.
Which is a pretty exciting note to be cut off on.
Mm-hmm. Intense. They are getting very close to the truth.
So intense.
Mm-hmm. Well, what a great episode. The mythology is really beginning to pick up. I mean, I feel like every time I rewatch these mythology episodes, I like it better, not worse.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. Especially, you know, now that we're sort of watching it and going through the mythology and I'm really trying to concentrate really hard on the mythology part of the episodes. It's really, I'm really picking up on things that I didn't pick up on before. And it's great. When I think about Anasazi, I haven't watched it in a while because usually I just skip straight to Paperclip because I love it so much. I do like Anasazi. I've always liked it a lot. But when I think about it, all I can ever really remember is Scully shooting Mulder. Everything else is kind of Scully shooting Mulder and then the boxcar at the end. Everything else is kind of a blur in my mind. But then rewatching it just this week, I was like, wow, they packed a lot of story into this.
Yeah.
And there was just a lot of really interesting things going on. It's just a great, great episode.
It's worth pointing out, too, because I don't think we've mentioned this, that Anasazi is the Native American tribe that
right.
disappeared without a trace. And that's kind
600
of
600 years ago.
Yeah, it was kind of an ongoing theme in the episode, like nothing disappears yeah. without a trace.
And that's a real thing, too. The Anasazi is kind of like this mystery. So mm-hmm, mm-hmm. it's an interesting story in and of itself. It doesn't play a huge role in the episode, considering it's called Anasazi.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you say, the theme kind of is about the idea of things disappearing. So it just figures into that sort of imagery.
And the again, the callback, I have to keep bringing up the truth because I just see a lot of similarities. The idea that that's where Smoking Man goes to hide, and he tells Mulder the story of the Anasazi again and talks about yeah. how they were the first shadow government and, you know, all of that cool stuff.
Very so cool. The Anasazi whole thing is very cool in the X-Files universe.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. I mean, I do enjoy how worldly the mythology mm-hmm. is. Like, it really expands mm-hmm. all over the globe and deals with all kinds of different, you know, cultures, and it's just I think it's really, really well woven.
Yeah.
not entirely palatable all the time, but
yeah,
definitely interesting. And
it's very ambitious.
Yeah, ambitious is a great word too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's all I have to say. Did you have anything else to add about Anasazi?
I don't. I think that I've said all I have to say about it. It's a great episode. And yeah, wow. Like, there feels like there's a whole season's worth of mythology in that one episode. And it's so entertaining and so tightly done. And the characterization is still great and interesting as well at the same time. Yeah. So it's really hitting on all cylinders. It's really right up there in terms of a well-executed mythology episode. This is one of the best.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you guys, let us know what you think about Anasazi. If there's anything we missed or anything you guys wanted to chat about, you can hit us up at XFD Podcast on Twitter. And we are going to, instead of kind of rotating back and forth, we're going to continue. Our next episode will be the remainder of this trilogy. So you guys will get to hear Blessing Way and Paperclip next time. Thanks, you guys, for listening. And we will be back with you in 2 weeks on X-Files Diaries.